What's happening, guys? Happy Friday, and thank you for joining another special episode of Your Welcome. UFC 303 is one day away, and coming up on today's show, I'm going to give you my official predictions for Vieira versus Prochaska Part 2, Ortega versus Lopez, and Ian Garry taking on MVP. But before all that, I got some choice words for Conor McGregor and Jorge Masvidal. Lots to get to, folks. Let's start here. Armand Sakarian suspended for 9 months. Fined $50,000. I'm rounding numbers here. I want to get to this. Obed Arden is the gentleman that Sakarian threw a punch at. I'm actually never been clear if that punch landed or not. I flipped him off. This is Obed Arden speaking. I flipped him off, nothing else. Congrats to Aram on a great performance. And best of luck against whoever he fights for the title. That's this guy's comment. Who is this guy? This guy's awesome. That guy is awesome. I don't think most people would have that attitude. And you guys know what I'm talking about. Maybe I need to back up a little bit. UFC 300, Sakarian's walking out. He's taking on Charles Oliveira. As Sakarian's coming out, something happens. Something happened. The whole thing was so fast. I got to kind of leave it at that. I don't know if the guy reached out and touched him or if it was a situation like that at all, but Sakarian like stopped what he was doing and took a step. Couldn't reach him at first. He actually closed distance to get to him, then threw a punch. We couldn't see if the punch landed. There's my vantage point off of my memory. I thought that was done. Not only I think it was done, I never thought it started. I didn't think that ever went anywhere. And then I read today that Sakarian had been suspended. And not only was he given the suspension, it was a retroactive suspension to the night that happened, which roughly, again, off the top of my head, was April 9th. And moreover, they would reduce the suspension if Sakarian produced an anti-bullying video. Okay. So then you got dude who I just quoted there who could have come out and gotten attention and done this whole thing and had a lawsuit and had a settlement. And he tells him we're all good. And by the way, good luck in your next fight. All right. I bring this to you because I find the rules to be fascinating. Nobody else does. Like, I am all alone. I was over here talking to you guys day after day about Charles Oliveira being stripped of the title for missing weight in Arizona and proclaiming to you that if that would have been tested, it would have been a very interesting battle. I've sat over here day after day and told you if Conor McGregor took on USADA based on the 180 days that USADA is claiming he has to be in the pool when he returns to the pool, that would have been a very interesting fight. And these things are all opinion. And that's one thing that people don't understand. It's like they get mad at a doctor if they go to the doctor and the doctor gives them a misdiagnosis. They want to sue him. And it's like, well, I don't totally blame you for that, but there isn't medicine. Just like there isn't law. You practice medicine. They don't know. And the same thing goes with law. And you will hear people come out and go, well, this is the rule, and therefore take Charles's belt. It's like, well, I read that rule differently, and I don't think you had the power to take his belt. But we never get to that unless it's tested, which means when they went to take Charles's belt, he pushed back. And you wonder why I don't talk about it very much? For some reason, other people just aren't interested in that. But the Sakarian one, for me, I was there. I happened to be right next to the ring. I saw Hunter Campbell go over and have the conversation with Sakarian as he was coming down the steps of the octagon to leave, where Hunter offered Sakarian the title shot opposite Islam in Atlantic City, which ended up being a spot taken by Dustin Poirier. And to me, that's interesting. Sakarian turned it down. Insert Dustin. Well, what if Sakarian had not turned it down? Generally, on a suspension. Right or wrong? I actually have a big problem with this being right. But right or wrong, as soon as you are accused and or suspected, you are thus suspended. Right there, boom, you're suspended. Pending a hearing. So then you have to wait until you get into the hearing. Now, let's just say you were cleared, which you will never find an example where that's happened, but let's just say that the person was cleared. You can't get those dates back, so you would have already missed the fight. In Sakarian's case, he would have missed the world title fight had he accepted it, at least in theory. Therein lies my question. What if he was suspended? I'm talking about Sakarian. What if he was suspended exactly like I just told you? $50,000, 9 months, send a video, anti-bullying, reduce the whole thing. What if that happened? But he did accept the fight. So would have it been a case where he would have been able to go to Atlantic City, fought Islam, regardless of result, and then come in and get the hearing, which is then suspended, which, by the way, would be impossible to do retroactive if he was busy and at work. And it just, I'm just asking the question, right? It gets complicated. It gets complicated, and there is no clear answer. And the fact that there's no clear answer frustrates some people, but it comes back to my initial premise that there are no rules. There are no rules if somebody resists. There's only what you think the rules are. Much like everybody thought they had the right to take the belt off Charles. I'm here to tell you, they did not. But they do if Charles says, yeah, you do. Those are the rules, and that's the way it goes, and here's the belt back. So I trust Sir Karen will make the video. I trust Sir Karen will be returned. But when you're suspended, there are so incredibly many bylaws and subsections to the rules that the audience never knows. And nor should you. But let me just offer one for you. If you are a suspended athlete, not only are you not allowed to fight, you are not allowed to train. Well, what the hell does that mean? I mean, in all fairness, what does that mean? And you're going, you can't go in the gym. Okay, fine. Is that what training is? Like, how are you going to define training? Can I go in the treadmill in my garage when nobody's there? Because the rule says I can't train. But what if that isn't training? What if that's called exercise? Like, where is the difference? I realize I'm being silly, but do you see the problem? Now, also within the rules, if you train with, if you are the partner and sparring partner of, if you are a corner man or a coach and you are working with, helping to train an athlete who is under suspension, you can be suspended. Are you ready for that? And now, that's never been tested. You will not find a person throughout history that ever had their license in jeopardy or had to have a hearing for training or training with somebody who was suspended. But the rule is still there. So it becomes a very interesting spot if somebody wanted it to be. And my largest point of all of this isn't to bring to you ridiculous rules that exist that everybody looks the other way because they're silly. I don't disagree with you, but what is the point of having a rule if it's not going to be enforced? Why'd you write it down in the first place? Who was the fool that raised his hand and threw it out before somebody said, I agree, and they brought the gavel down? Like, how did this happen in the first place? If it was silly and we were going to look the other way, why did we do it? So when you're in Sarkarian's place, see, and the reason these become interesting is Ryan Garcia is largely going through the same thing. There is not a distinction within the rules for why you were suspended. There is no distinction. If you're suspended for punching somebody retroactively in a $50,000 fine until that time has elapsed and that fine has been paid, both have to be true. Or you are suspended for X amount of time and a fine, both of which have to be remedied for a performance-enhancing drug. There is no distinction. The suspension is still the suspension, and everything around the suspension still applies. Interesting spot. Maybe you think so, maybe you don't. I thought Conor versus USADA was going to be the fight of the century, and I think that Charles should have went and got his belt back, and he should have got participation points on the pay-per-view, of which he forfeited along with the belt because he didn't know to stand up and push back. But that is just my opinion. Times in this sport where the rules don't apply, but they don't come along very often. They really don't. There's almost a scientific formula to build it. Do you remember that guy? He went down. Was his name Perlman? I can't think of his name, but he was known for building boy bands. Turned out he was running a Ponzi scheme, and they put him in federal prison. But he had a formula that no one else had. He knew it. He had a formula where he could take five guys in a band, and they were roughly such and such age, and he could take them to the top. Do you remember this guy that I'm talking about? Because MMA... there are similar formulas. There's just not very many guys that know them. But unlike a perfect math equation, sometimes you type everything in and you get a different answer. Like sometimes 2 + 2 = 4. And you run into a spot where a guy does everything wrong, but he's got the right wins and he's got the right ranking. But He's done everything wrong. He has not built the fight. The promotion's not interested in it. You aren't interested in it. The box office isn't going to be great. Your media partners don't want to interview him and talk about it. At the same time, to show a respect to the integrity of the rankings, which you only created to create controversy, but to show a respect to the integrity of the ranking, you got to hold a fight. Even if it's not going to draw, you got to do it. Or you'll have times where the boys all stand back and go, this is the guy. Well, then you have to go with him. You don't have a choice. Like, in many ways, Sarkarian is in an interesting spot. Like, I'm very confident in telling you, if Islam returns to 155, Islam's next fight is against Sarkarian. Now, illness or injury, of course, makes us throw everything out. But I don't know that in a normal circumstance, the way that Sarkarian has played this would get him that opportunity. He just found himself in a spot where all the rest of the guys have stood back. For example, one of the great voices of the sport, Justin Gaethje, who is, and I'm going back in time here, but leading into 300. Gaethje's on the card at 300. Max is entering the weight class, and he's doing it at 300. Sarkarian is on the card opposite Oliveira at 300. So now these guys are in an absolute battle for who's going to get the nod. But Gaethje, who's the most listened to of all of them, came out and said, I am going to beat Max, and I am going to fight Islam later in the year. The winner of Oliveira and Sarkarian is going to fight him first. Now, where that becomes relevant is once that said, there is not a scenario or an example in history that you could give me where somebody in the office picks up the phone and goes, oh, no, hey, we're actually going to do this first. It doesn't happen. You won't find an example in history where a guy comes out and says, I am the number three guy, and the office calls, hey, man, you're being a little hard on yourself. You're number one. You won't find a time that that's happened. They were going to give Corey Sandhagen a fight. Corey Sandhagen said that fight should go to Aljo. That fight went to Aljo, and to this day, Sandhagen never had the fight. And I don't say that to pick on him. I'm just reminding you that each and every one of those words do matter. There is a game being played. There is nothing more important than making sure that you have a call-out. You can't make any money if you don't have an opponent. The punches and the kicks don't feed your family as much as you want them to and think that they do, or even think that they should. You must have an opponent. So now that we've established the importance of the call-out, the most important thing in the call-out is that you do not look weak within the industry. And the most important thing that you can have, and I'm talking from a financial perspective, I'm talking about sticking around. I'm talking about making sure you have a job tonight, and regardless of the outcome, you have a job tomorrow. You must appear as though you have power. Nobody does. It's all an act. Nobody's got any stroke. You must appear that you do, which is the importance of the call out. That if you get the fight, great. I mean, that's slam dunk. But then there's other things. You could get a response. You could get put down and brushed off, but you still got something. All of those things are better than not getting it and being ignored. That is where you have now displayed for everybody watching that you have no power within the business. So whoever you call out, right? And they're all call-outs, guys. Please don't get that wrong. That's another one of the misses by so many. Hey, man, I just want to sit back, see what happens. I'll take on all comers. Okay, great. Many people are going to say you failed to do a call-out. No, you didn't. You just gave a call-out. Many people will say, I'm going to sit back and wait. Okay, great. But you can't interpret that he didn't call him out. No, you just called someone out. You just called out wait. That is who you called out. Many people will say, I don't care who my next opponent is. Okay, great. It's not that you failed to call someone out. You just did. You said that it doesn't matter. You said that your next fight doesn't matter. So I can guarantee you it won't be for a title because those matter. I can guarantee you it won't be in a main event because those matter. I can guarantee you, regardless of who it is, it won't even be in a feature bout because those types of things matter. And you just called out, it doesn't matter. And the reason I tell you these things is I'm looking at Sean Strickland, okay? And I have a special feeling in my heart for Sean Strickland. That's well disclosed. I don't hide that. But Sean Strickland has got a very good argument right now. Like, if you were to go to a jury and present your case for number one contender, I am very confident, even with those 12 people not smart enough to get out of jury duty, they would give it to Sean Strickland. But Sean has now said he's going to wait. Now, there are times, that would be the wrong way to play it. But there are times when you can play it wrong and it still comes down to you. Because all the rest of the guys stand back, or the rankings suggest, or the current champion says, you're next. Like, there's ways. And what should Sean do? Like, Sean is in such a unique spot that if he was next and he was put in a position to wait, very rare thing in our sport. But one of the reasons I can see that being the right move for Sean is regardless of who wins, like Sean versus Duplessis, there is a story and there is a piece of unfinished business there that has got to be wrapped up. I mean, the very judges the night of the fight didn't agree with one another. Like, we have unfinished business. And the same thing goes with Izzy. It was so unbelievable. Izzy was a 6-1 favorite and lost all 5 rounds. Like, it was one of those things where, okay, you know what? I saw it. Good job to Sean. I got to see it again. It's one of those things where Sean could draw in against either one of those guys. It just always becomes a problem when you say, I'm going to wait. It's one of those spots. It's one of those spots because if that's who you get, if that's your call out is to wait, and let's say that you get it, you're taking off a very meaningful player from the board. Oh, by the way, there's an example and a precedence that now gets set that isn't the one. It isn't the one they want out there. So how could have Sean said it better? And if Sean's just going by the facts of I should have this fight because, and he's arguing against Robert Whittaker and he's talking about common opponents, he's right. And he's got a lot of strength on the argument. But if Robert appears to be more willing to step in than Sean in our industry, that's a huge nod. And I think as Sean is saying he's going to wait, he should further his case. Like, wait is one way to say it. I've eliminated everybody else. It's the same thing, but it's different words. Sean has eliminated everybody else, is his point for why you should be number one contender. Sean versus Izzy works all day. I don't know that you could do great business with Izzy and Whittaker. Just for example, I mean, that would be 3 times, and that's kind of uncommon. And we have a couple of examples we can turn to, but not many. And it's not enough that I would take the spot from Whittaker, but it does add to a uniqueness of Sean. Like, I really don't know. I would love to see Sean versus Duplessis, and I would love to see Sean versus Izzy because of the story and the backstory there. And I have to be real fair with you. Like, I got the power to say which one. I don't know which one I want to see more. Like, those are very interesting matches for their own reasons. But the problem with weight is when you think that you're having to beat out everybody else in the contenders, right? You got your top 10 list. You're looking at all the top 10 guys. And of the top 10, only the top 5 are in a discussion for a title fight. So you look at those guys and you say, man, I'm going to wait. None of these guys can pass me. None of these guys deserve to. I've already beaten these guys. I'm going to wait right here. And it makes sense. You look around and it makes sense. And the one thing that people miss when they're looking at the rank, I'm ranked number one and they're all here. What they miss is, well, there's actually 2 guys in front of you. But you don't see them on the page. If you're staring at the page, you don't see the 2 guys here. You go, well, there are no 2 guys. I'm number one. Everybody's down here. It's like, no, there's 2 guys in front of you. And that is the 2 guys that already have the bout agreement signed. That is the actual championship match that you have to wait for. And if that match plays out in a certain way, if it needs to be rematched, it needs to be immediately rematched. And you can go into the history of our sport, they're not the same. There's a number of rematches they do just fine. There's a number of rematches that you really wanted to see. The ones that did well were the ones that needed rematched. And how do we know they needed rematch? Because they were immediately rematched. It's a completely different vibe and feel to if you rematch down the road or you do an immediate rematch. It's a completely different feel. And you want to be careful. You want to be careful putting yourself in that boat of waiting for two guys that are going to fight, particularly if they're going to fight again, now all of a sudden it can be a year down the road. And I get that things can change, and I get that opinions can change. I get sensitive. I read all the stuff that Sean puts out. I like the stuff he puts out. But when he says wait, I believe that he was making a case between himself and Robert Whittaker and why he should be the one, and therefore he will wait for it. And I just remind you that there's a different way to word it, and there's a different way to say it, and those words do matter. They're all being paid attention to. Food for thought. Strickland is definitely the top contender. He's the top-ranked guy. He definitely should be the backup fighter if there is one. He definitely should be next, regardless of the winner, for Du Plessis versus Izzy, in my opinion. Sean Strickland's video going around. He's sparring with a former K-1 champion, or he's sparring with a former K-1 fighter. Like, don't think you need to correct me in that section. I didn't know the gentleman, but I respect K-1. I know that if you're kickboxing with an actual kickboxer, it's a mess. Like, that's when you find out what a sport that is, what an art, if you will, that is. But you don't find it out if you're sparring MMA against a kickboxer. It's got to be specific. Like, the threat of the takedown will change a kickboxer. So when you go with Sean Strickland, who doesn't ever take anybody down, like, just right off the bat, if you're good with striking, even if you're not an MMA guy, you could go get work with Strickland. Like, he will allow you to get work. So, and the reason I said I couldn't recognize this guy, he's in headgear. Sean's not in headgear. But when they're sparring, it appears that conditioning has become a factor. I mean, Sean is doing what he would like, and the other gentleman is really not firing back, which I'm not convinced is because of an overwhelm of technique. I assume there was fatigue, but when I do see it, I do wonder, how good are some of these guys? And I will never get my way. The closest I ever got was Little Noguera, who decided he was going to make an Olympic team when the Olympic Games were in Rio. Was that 2012? I believe it was. So what I'm talking about is some of these guys, if you were to put them in a pure art, like mixed martial arts is a combination of a number of arts. And while mixed martial arts does not exist in the Olympic Games, individual arts that when you put together an equal mixed martial arts do, for example, Taekwondo, for example, Judo, for example, freestyle and Greco-Roman wrestling. For example, boxing. So when you see a mixed martial artist, sometimes I do wonder just how far can they go in one of these specific disciplines. Like, let me throw one at you. Kayla Harrison, who's as decorated of an amateur athlete as anyone that's ever done mixed martial arts. In fact, with 2 gold medals, I believe that would make her the most decorated amateur ever. And the same thing would go with Clarissa Shields, where when they come over to MMA and they're starting to pursue that, they will openly tell you that they could not just go sign up for their individual sport, whether it was boxing or case judo, and make the Olympic team. That even though they've done that before and even won the Olympic Games, because they're focused on MMA, they could not just go show up and make the team. To make the team, they would have to train and specialize and really focus in this one area. And that makes sense to me. And that's also what I've seen. And no matter how good a guy does in MMA, we go, wow, he's got really good hands. It's not as though he could just go to boxing. I don't think. I remember the first time my dad saw Vitor Belfort. And my dad said he should go to boxing. He should be fighting Mike Tyson. And I remember thinking, like, Dad, that is a massive leap. Vitor was like 19 or 20. And he looked quick. Vitor had something called the march step, where you would step in front so that each hand became a power hand. There was never a jab. And it was unique, and we hadn't seen it before. And he was powerful. And he won quickly, but to make believe that he could just switch into boxing, oh, by the way, take on Mike Tyson. Like, it was just, I thought it was a massive leap when my dad said it. It was such a surprise to me that I remembered all these years later. And then you look at somebody where I would tell you as a wrestler, I'm more than just a wrestler. I'm a wrestling fanatic. The best wrestler, and I don't mean decorated pedigree. I mean the one who could wrestle the best in MMA, as a matter of fact, in the history of MMA, is George St. Pierre. So if that statement's true, am I saying if we put a singlet on George, he's a Canadian, so we'll just use Canada, he shows up to the Olympic trials in Canada, he would make the Olympic team for wrestling? And no, that would be crazy. I think it would be crazy. There's no way for me to actually know, but I don't think you could do that. Like, they don't translate and they don't totally carry over, and you go from this posture to this posture, and it's just different, I would think. At the same time, Josh Koscheck could show up and make the Canadian Olympic team. That's true. Johnny Hendricks could show up and make the Olympic team in Canada. That's also true. Just two guys that come to mind, and George out-wrestled both of them. But he out-wrestled them not in wrestling, in MMA. So where does it, where is the change is what I'm suggesting. Like, if Sean Strickland could go out and do that in a video to a K-1 fighter, does it mean that he could go out and be a K-1 fighter? Or if that fighter was even a K-1 champion, does that mean that Sean could go and do well or even be a K-1 champion? Like, I respect those arts in and of themselves, but should I? Is that wrong? Am I wrong? Was my father closer to right than I am? When he saw Vitor and he saw that power and he saw the march set, he's like, come right at you. Was barely a heavyweight and winning the heavyweight tournament. Was my dad right? And guys in our sport greatly respect Abu Dhabi. That's the one. That's the one specific grappling event people in our sport really respect. Do we have somebody, do we have a good enough jiu-jitsu player who, while doing MMA, could go over, qualify or get an invite, and then win Abu Dhabi? Because when I watch what Francis Ngannou did to Tyson Fury, which is the single most remarkable sporting event of my life, the single most, I cannot explain that should not have happened, OMG moment of my life, was the 10 rounds that Francis had opposite Fury. A split oh my goodness, Francis Ngannou was one guy's opinion away from being the heavyweight champion of the world on his debut. Oh my goodness. At any rate, when you see that, can we all just agree that if we had brought it down to the amateur level, that Francis Ngannou could have made the Olympic team? The gentleman who did make the Olympic team in the heavyweight class from the country that Francis obtains a passport, so you understand, is 17 years old. He's a junior in high school. Can we agree, without even knowing who he is or even looking at him, can we agree that Francis Ngannou could beat him up based on what we saw him do with Fury? I don't know. It's one of those, I don't know. I would sure think so. I have the same thought with Conor McGregor. When he goes out for 30 minutes and beats up Floyd Mayweather, if we were to bring that down to an amateur level, and Ireland is very skilled and very known for their amateur boxers, but it was still a child, still a kid, versus a grown man in Conor. Can we agree that Conor could have gone down and made the Olympic team? I mean, the only reason Floyd beat him is because he got him tired, and it took him 30 minutes to do that. In amateur boxing, it's only 9 minutes in total. Three-minute rounds. Can we agree that Conor would have made the team in Ireland? And if so, and he goes to the Olympics, do you think he would have won them? Do you think he would have medaled? Like, for me, that's just an interesting concept. And the closest that we got was Little Nog. Little Nog, still fighting in the UFC, went through the process. And he won the Brazilian Nationals, which made him the number one guy. And he went to the final box off. And it was kind of quiet, like how this worked, to the point that I don't know. He lost the final box off. But I think it was 2 out of 3, and I think he won one of them, and he lost the other two, or it was a split decision, like whatever happened, but he was that close, and it makes you wonder, well, what if he wasn't doing MMA at the same time? What if he wasn't practicing jiu-jitsu once a day? What if it was just all boxing? How far could have he gone? I go down this road. Not as an athlete, by the way. I go down this route as a coach and now a father. What if my son wants to go in to that sport of MMA, the sport that I know so well? could I arm him with the absolute best way to train? Do I know the absolute best way to train? I think we would first default, the first pitfall in human thinking would be to default to what we did. And I'm stronger than that. I'm stronger and knowledge enough to not do that. Just because I did it doesn't make it so. But could I watch what somebody else did? And if I did, who would I be studying? And then you got to wonder, is that right? I mean, Francis Ngannou can prepare and show up and have one professional licensed judge say that he should be heavyweight champion of the world. Like if he can do that, apparently you don't need 14, 15 years twice a day, every day. Buckle down, hunker down. Apparently you don't. There's other ways. And Little Nog, certainly in shape, certainly aggressive and a good athlete, lots of things that would transfer. But as far as just the lefts and the rights, hands, I mean, he went from not boxing to the national champion in Brazil pretty quickly. And then I see Sean Strickland, who only was kickboxing against a top kickboxer. And Sean Strickland is leading the dance. Like, just how far can you go? I wish more people would try. I truly do. I wish when the Olympics rolled around, some of our big stars would go try in their respective disciplines. But they don't see it the same way. They see the amateurs as something that you get out of. Once you get out of it, I put my time out, I never have to go back. They don't have the same respect for it, I suppose, as you would say, or appreciation that I do. I'm a fan. But I'm also curious. And when I see that Olympics and I see that flag go up and I hear that anthem and I see that person standing on the podium, my entire life, I've always thought that person was the best. But for the first time ever, I'm starting to wonder, like, do the best always show up? Do the best even want to prove it through that platform? Or do they want to prove it through something else? Just how good in a K-1 straight up kickboxing situation, just how good would Sean Strickland have done? Guys, when I started podcasting, an online store was the furthest thing on my mind, but now we're selling Bad Guy Inc. merchandise. That includes coffee. That includes t-shirts. Go get yourself a sticker if you would like. And you know what? It's very easy. And that's all because we use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you to sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's where you go to help your business grow. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel or selling custom accessories, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, whenever and wherever you're selling from, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers and the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I appreciate about Shopify is no matter how big you grow, you don't have to feel overwhelmed by the demand. Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level with ease. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chale, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/chale right now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/chale. As spring makes its way into summer, there will be more outdoor festivals and concerts happening all around us. And if you're in the market for some new attire, let Tecovas help you out. A great pair of Western boots will elevate a casual look or add a refined flair that'll draw both eyes and compliments. I've seen some youngsters out there pull off wearing a nice pair of Tecovas ostrich boots with shorts. I've worn mine to a UFC event with a full suit head to toe. There is no limit to how you can wear a pair of boots, and the best way to shop for boots is at your local Tecovas store, where you're going to be greeted by the smell of fresh leather and a friendly smile. Go on in, grab a cold one, get fitted by a pro, and shop the latest styles. Tecovas also offers custom branding and leather stamping if you want to personalize your boots or fine leather goods. Visit Tecovas.com. That's Tecovas, TECOVAS.com. And don't go gently, y'all. I recently started taking Morning Kick, used and created by former karate champion Chuck Norris. Guys, I've never felt better. By the way, have you seen Chuck lately? It's like he's aging backwards. This guy is still throwing kicks. He's full of energy, and he's in his 80s. This is why I jumped at the shot of taking his revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions. This drink combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other greens out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade, and it has hundreds of five-star reviews. And by the way, I never tell you something tastes a certain way if it doesn't. It tastes just like strawberry lemonade. Since I started drinking Morning Kick, my digestion is smoother. My body looks leaner. I have energy all day. I just feel sharp. I want you to go to roundhouseprovisions.com/chael. Now, that's gonna save you up to 44% off the regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost in energy, and just an overall healthier body, go to roundhouseprovisions.com/chael today. The toe of Conor McGregor and why on earth it is still being talked about. Well, you might ask yourself that, but allow me to answer you. For example, you've got Joe Rogan has defended it. Alex Pereira has appeared to defend it. Two different ways you could interpret what Pierre said, but I think he was defending it. And a couple of other fighters as well. And largely the statement comes down to just having heart and saying, hey, somebody doesn't have to get into something as hard as this against someone as good as Chandler when they're hurt. That's true. I don't know that anybody would disagree with that. But the support of pulling out of a cage fight because of an injured pinky toe, they're fainting. They don't mean it. I had to live through this one other time. It was the last Olympic Games, and it was Simone Biles. She got over there and she pulled out. You had these other gymnasts who 100% of them, with no exception, were disgusted. They could not believe that this happened, that a leader of a team, and it only comes along every 4 years, and there's only so many opportunities, and one is going to you, and you're pulling out due to a mental, you call it weakness, you call it lapse. She admitted she was not physically hurt, that it was bothering her. She was having these thoughts on her mind. I mean, do you guys remember this? And they were defending her left and right when they would come out publicly. I remember standing back going, wait a minute, I know you, and I know you, and I actually just hung up the phone with you, and I'm on a text thread with you. None of them meant it. It was the most insincere, but they didn't say it. It was one of these interesting things. And that's okay. Like, you can go out and be polite. I was just surprised that all of them in unison were. It was as though somebody who was holding the camera told them before they went on, here's the line that we're taking. Because it was so wildly opposite of what every one of them felt. And the reason I'm telling you that this is still a topic within Conor McGregor, it's not because he pulled out against Chandler for the toe. And when we sit and poke fun at him and go, okay, listen, you're in rehab. You don't actually have a bad toe, right? Like, that isn't the point either. That's just commentary and you're just talking to have fun. The reason it's relevant is it's very hard to imagine something smaller than a pinky toe. It's hard to imagine. of which may or may not have been broken. It's just hard to imagine. And the reason it's relevant and important is not because the fight is off or the fight has been changed. It's your guess to the future. Does the fight ever get remade? If a discolored pinky toe, like, is there a realistic scenario where you believe you could go through a training camp, you could have guys of this age on the backside of 30, training and working and going hard. Is there a realistic scenario where you believe that whatever the date, whenever that rolls around, they could enter fight week with less discomfort than a discolored pinky toe? Like, there's a big belief within the commentary of, hey, Conor shouldn't have to fight with that pinky toe. And that's a real advantage to Michael Chandler. And the belief becomes that Michael Chandler feels great, which of course he does not. Michael Chandler has ailments and he's hiding them. Every fighter on the card has ailments. There's a game. And ultimately, under penalty of perjury, you're going to sign a form through the commission, which is overseen by the Attorney General's office, which works at the pleasure of the governor. Like, it's a really big deal that whatever your story is, you stick to it. So all the guys in all 11 fights are going to say that there is nothing ailing them, and they all feel great, and then they're going to sign. Of course that's not true. That's ridiculous. How would that possibly be true? How could you possibly train for a cage fight where you're either doing jiu-jitsu, which has two recommendations: break a guy's limb or strangle him unconscious. Those are the two things that you're trying to do in jiu-jitsu. How could you possibly train on the day of boxing? No matter what the gloves and what the headgear, and you might even have somebody that comes put Vaseline on you. How could you possibly be punched by another trained puncher for an entire day, of which once you make it through, you come in the next day, and that's going to be kickboxing day. Now you're going to do the same thing, except kicks are at it, and then the next day we're going to come in and we're going to spar MMA. Like, how within that process would anybody come out and feel good? So now that we understand that they don't, we have to ask ourselves, okay, everybody's banged up. Everybody's going to hurt. Everybody's going through the same tough grinding process. Is there a reason to believe we could show up? Because see, everybody's got a breaking point too, right? Like what one guy can deal with, I'm not saying that everyone else has to deal with. Conor McGregor teased me for tapping out to strikes. I don't know if that's actually true, but he teased me for, but that's his point. So now he's disclosing, I would never do, like, whatever it was that would happen, I would go unconscious, or I would be split open, I'd make the referee pull him off. I would never tap in that situation. Oh, fair enough. I would never complain if I had a hurt pinky toe. I would never pull out of a fight. But that doesn't make me the tougher guy or Conor the tougher guy. I'm sharing that everybody has their point. So the reason the toe is such a big deal and it's being talked about still is, can we reasonably believe they're going to have less than a discolored pinky toe the next time the fight rolls around? That's the question that we're asking. Now that we know what your breaking point is, now that we know what your level of discomfort that you can push through versus you got to stop, and now that we know that it's a pinky toe, is there any reason to even discuss rematching that fight? Because there is not a realistic scenario where you can go through the training and or preparation and we could expect there to be anything less than a pinky toe. That's the reason it's relevant. And the hell am I to judge, right? I'd be a great judge had I had that injury. I would be a great, you want to know the worst pain? I had a rib that went out. Some people would think that's not a big deal. Like, you go to the doctor, they can't put in a cast. There's nothing they can do. You just got to live with it. But it was hard to do anything. It was hard to get a deep breath. One of the other great pains I've ever had was just a broken finger. Oh my goodness, it hurt so bad. So I'm not saying like it's got to be some big body part. I haven't dealt with the toe. I don't know. I know Rulon Gardner got stuck in the woods when his snowmobile broke down, got frostbite, had to have three of his toes chopped off, came back, tried to make an Olympic team. Like, different guys are going to deal with it in different ways. I don't know that I tapped out to strikes. I don't know if that actually happened. But apparently Connor is the type of guy that would not. I wouldn't judge it. But you're going to have to give it a look. You're going to have to understand why this topic is still here. And you're going to have to ask yourself, on one hand, when Connor said, hey, we can do this thing, we can do it in August. You have Dana coming over the top of it and saying, I got my cards filled up in August, and I'm not changing them, and he's not part of it. Like, why is there this push and pull? What is the reservation? If, in fact, it is a toe, and we can talk to doctors, and they can tell us, with very good belief, exactly when that toe is going to be healed, why could we not just look at a calendar and book it? Well, there's the answer to your question. Is there any reasonable belief that going through the preparation for a sport like this, you could show up with less than a hurt pinky toe? No. No, there's no reasonable belief you can do that. Is there any reasonable belief that of the 11 fights you're going to see Saturday, any one of them, from main event to curtain jerker, is more uncomfortable at this very moment in time than a discolored pinky toe? No. No, they all are dealing with something and will lie and take it to their grave just to have this opportunity and just to collect that paycheck. So, unless you're going to wrap them in cotton, is there a way to rebook that fight? Having the information that you're armed with now, you do what you want with the statement I just made. I'm simply sharing with you why Connor and the pinky toe is still being discussed. George Masvidal slams Connor McGregor for avoiding him and claims he's a bigger draw than Michael Chandler. That's a headline over at Elbow right now. Can George Masvidal read? Does he read? There'd be a difference, right? And I would stop right now if he in fact cannot read. But my guess is he just doesn't. But I don't know a guy that gets more things wrong than Masvidal. Like, Masvidal will come out and say, well, so-and-so said, and therefore I'm upset with him. Like, I end up in my own thing with Masvidal. Well, now I got to whip his ass over it. But I didn't want to have to whip his ass over it. I would have preferred to just explain to him that what he was told was incorrect, that he's got bad information. But then we got in too deep. And, like, there's guys that don't read. They don't go and check out the news, but they live in the orbit of MMA, so people they talk to will tell them certain things, and they can feel as though they're up to speed. They can feel like they know what's going on, even though they didn't go to Bloody Elbow themselves, just for example. And Masvidal has done this to me where he's given a quote, I'm upset with Chael, because, and here's what Chael said. And I'll hear him say it and go, no, I didn't. Like, that just simply didn't happen. And there was a period of time where I thought, well, I could just explain this. You've gotten bad information. And then there was a period of time where I was like, okay, you know, either way, I'm going to have to whip your ass over it. I'm going to have to whip your ass, one, for saying I said it, two, for having it wrong, three, for having the reaction you had, four, for thinking that you have an opinion in the first place. Whether I said it or I didn't say it, you're going to sit there and live with it. Like, at some point, that's where George and I ended up. But he's now doing that to Connor. He's first claiming that he, George Masvidal, is a bigger draw than Michael Chandler. Fine. Fine, I like that kind of talk. I'm okay with it. Did he forget that he retired? Like, it's one of the interesting spots. The fact that George Masvidal is calling out Conor McGregor, calling for a fight with Conor McGregor, or wanting Conor to fight with him. It's like, okay, but George, you do understand that Conor McGregor is under contract with a company located in Las Vegas, Nevada, known as the Ultimate Fighting Championships. Is that true or false? Are you aware of that statement? Okay, great. Are you aware that you retired from the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Okay, great. Now, George, there is some fine print to that, which is you weren't smart enough to get out of your contract. So even though you said I retire because you didn't want to get cut, your contract is still running. Like, you can't actually go somewhere else. And that's fine. You just think that we all know that. But people don't know that. I know that because I know the business. But other people don't. They think that you're out, that you're free. They read about you. They see that you're getting ready to box Nate. They think that you're done. But you didn't do what Nate did. You didn't actually finish your contract. You were worried, coming off of yet another loss, that they weren't going to give you another fight. To save face, you retired. You later found out, yeah, they might have ran me back one more time. Ran out of money and are trying to pull it back, but you haven't disclosed that to the audience. So the audience believes you, who's out and now in the boxing world, cannot, per contractual reasons, even get a fight with Conor McGregor, who, by the way, is in a completely different weight class than you. Now, to appreciate anything that I'm saying, it's not as though you'd have to be literate or you'd have to be able to read or that you'd have to choose who you're getting your information from. You would just have to be a reasonable person that understands that Conor McGregor, part one, has business opposite Michael Chandler, to start with. Conor McGregor, part two, actually has never really backed down from anybody, and if the story was to stop right now, except for Michael Chandler. But part three, Conor McGregor was never offered George Masvidal. He was never offered George Masvidal because George Masvidal was on a losing streak. Oh, by the way, left the company, and the entire time was at a different weight class. So it's an interesting spot. Like, are you trying to create headlines? If you are, more power to you. But if you were doing that, that would make me a mark, which means you somehow had a more sophisticated mindset and made me fall for it. And there's like no world where that would have happened. Or do you forget that you, to save face, believing you would not be given another fight, retired in front of the world, and only you knew that your contract was not up, and only you know that you've still got a contract running with the UFC who could stop you from doing the Moxley match opposite Nate Diaz, but you forgot to disclose that to the audience? Like, there's nothing wrong with any of that. There's nothing that George should be ashamed of or embarrassed about. It's just a matter of that he forgot. It appears that he forgot. He told the world he's done. And at the time that he did that, he had a secret. He knew that his contract was not expired. Not a big deal. Just the reality. So now he's acting as though he wants back in. But you don't get to come back in, and you don't get to come in against a star, and you don't get to come back into a big spot when you're the same guy who exited anyway because you thought that they wouldn't give you a match, and you may or may not have been right at that time. And you're doing it opposite a guy from a different weight class who's injured and has business with Michael Chandler, which you would know if you took the time to read. Ian Garry said that he has no interest in fighting Michael Venom Page. And I loved it. I thought that was great, by the way. And I could be personalizing it. I just remember doing that myself. Somebody would ask me about a fight. They think you're going to build it. They think you're going to hype it. I mean, I don't even want to do the fight. I don't. It wasn't even my idea. I got a phone call. I said I would do the fight. I don't want to do it. And you do have that feel sometimes as a fighter. And I always feel like the truth will set you free. Like, I feel like it is the best answer. Whatever the truth is, like, you're not smarter than the audience, particularly in a world of dum-dums known as cage fighters. Like, there is zero chance that they can outsmart the audience. And when they attempt to manufacture something, particularly conflict, it doesn't get them anywhere. So I don't have a problem. I like, if that is how Ian Garry feels, I like that he would say that. And he did qualify. He said, I don't know why I'm fighting him. I just beat the number 6 guy. Why would I want to fight the number 13 guy? Okay, great. I'm into it. I don't like the manufacturing of conflict. I don't like to make believe that you've got a problem when you don't have one. And I don't like a guy that doesn't know the difference between building a fight and getting a fight. There is a meaningful difference of what you will do strategically to get a fight, which means a bout agreement signed, versus what you will do to build the fight, which means to move tickets and pay-per-views. Great. Very few people know that there's a difference. I like that Garry, at least, even if it was on accident, sounds as though he understands. But I do want to answer his question, just in case he was sincere. Just in case he said, why am I, who just beat number 6, why am I, who broke into the top 10, why am I having to fight a guy that's not in the top 10? Well, let me answer it. You have to be able to go both ways. And there are so many guys that believe they are showing a bravado. They will take a fight that nobody else will. All right, step in the right direction. They will fight anybody at any time. Okay, great. Again, step in the right direction. But when they said that, what they had never considered is that it could go the other way. You will not only be asked to fight guys that are perceived to be bigger and stronger than you, where you can come up and show the courage and show the ability and get the applause and get the accolades. It can also go the other way, where you're going to fight somebody who is perceived to be less than you, perceived to be weaker than you, where you are not going to get the accolades. In fact, you will get nothing if you win. People are barely even going to tell you good job because it was expected that you were going to win. Can you go both ways? Very few guys can. And they don't know that they can't. They think they're the tough guy. They think that they're the man. Call me anytime. Call me in any weight class. Don't even tell me. Like, they think that's the attitude. And they're so close. Like, they've got a hold of the right tool. They just have it by the wrong end. And at some point, you will be tested. At some point, whether this is conscious by the organization or it's subconscious, at some point, before they put that belt around you, before they have got to be able to rely on you three times a year, they are going to test you to make sure you can go both ways. You can be the favorite and you can be the dog. You can be the experienced, you can be the inexperienced. You can be the one with everything to gain, you can be the one with everything to lose. That you, in fact, really are the anyone, anywhere, anytime. And when that statement is made and when that bravado comes out, even the guys that think they are that guy never considered the wind going both ways. They only considered it one direction. Do I have the courage? Would I actually do it? Would I step in there with anybody harder than me, more known than me, ranked higher than me, more experienced than me? They don't ever even consider that within the statement of anyone, anywhere, anytime, it also goes the other way. And before you're going to get those big placements, before you're going to get that belt, even have the risk of having to put the belt around you, we have to make sure that those three times a year that you're going to be called on, but now they're called on for feature spots because you've got the title, that you also have the mentality that goes with it. And I'm just answering the question. Ian Garry asked a question. Might have been rhetorical, but he asked the question. Why would I want to fight somebody ranked number 13 when I just got a guy that was number 6? If he is genuinely curious as to why this test is being put in front of him, there's his answer. After years of fine print contract and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if I have learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. Guys, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They don't have retail stores or salespeople. Instead, they deliver premium phone plans directly to you. I honestly thought the plans and pricing were too good to be true. I'm thankful I was wrong. The coverage and reliability with Mint Mobile has been superb. Say bye-bye to overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/chale. That's mintmobile.com/chale. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/chale. $45 up front. Payment required equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. MVP and Ian Garry, you know, in so many ways, this is the most compelling fight on the card. And in so many ways, it's the one with the most at stake. I don't know that there's a scenario for MVP. For example, if he loses to Garry, where he comes back, and it's not just a rankings issue. Like, a lot of times you go look at the rankings, I think that Gary's around 6. I know I'm close. And I think MVP's around 13. I know I'm close. Generally, if 13 loses to 6, it's not that big of a deal. Like life goes on. But sometimes you have to work in other numbers to the formula. And when number 13 is 37 years old and number 6 is 26 years old, it changes. Like, even if what happens is what is supposed to happen, which is what the odds makers at DraftKings are saying going to happen, what the rankings committee that comes out every Tuesday at 9 a.m. has already stated will happen. Sometimes when it does, it can be more detrimental. And I just share for you, there's a lot at stake here. A very reasonable person could make a very reasonable argument that Ian Garry should be fighting for the world championship right now. Like, in many ways, if this guy named Bilal Muhammad hadn't won 8 fights in a row and didn't have a history with Leon Edwards and they already had a contest and there was an eye poke, like, in many ways, if that guy, just this Bilal Muhammad, just didn't exist, Garry would be the guy. Isn't he ranked number 6 or something like that? Isn't he 14-0 or 15-0, something like that? He's got the backstory in the gym and used to train with Leon. Like, everything is there for Garry to be your number one contender. Everything. It just turned out that everything, plus a little bit for Muhammad, was there in this specific snapshot in time. And Garry and MVP fight a lot alike. And they both have enjoyed an advantage. And that advantage is the opponents are scared of them. Every single opponent that you will see Garry fight, even before he had a big name, was timid. All of them. And Garry is very by the book. I mean, he's going to have his hands up and his chin's down. And he's going to be bouncing on his feet. He is never going to strike you once. If he can touch you once, he will touch you twice. If he can touch you twice, he'll finish with a kick, reset, and do it again. But he will never start a sequence without a feint first. And that is somewhat advanced. Like, the average fan isn't going to know what that means. If you're standing there with a guy, just go out and hit him if you can, right? Yeah, I agree. But you're not training to fight the average guy. You're trained to fight the best guys in the world, and you can't just reach out and hit them. Their eyes and their time, that's too good. They're going to slip, and they're going to hit you back. It's going to be a thing. You've got to trick them first. You've got to do a feint. You got to lift this hand before you throw this hand. You got to flinch at them. You guys probably played a game of this begrudgingly when you were a kid. I know it was a thing on the school bus when I was growing up, where some jerk would and they say, two for flinch, and he'd punch you twice in the shoulder. It was just an annoying thing. But it's very real in professional fighting. You will flinch at the guy. You make him pause for just a second, and then you throw your punches. I bring that to you because Garry will do nothing until he does that feint first. And he can't. That will not change. Like, his body is trained. If you go and you watch him in practice and he's on the mitts with a coach, or he's on a heavy bag by himself, or he's shadow boxing, he will not let those hands go until he throws his feint first. The feint is the tell that he's coming, and he will never come until he tells you first. But he's so good at it that everybody reacts and everybody gets hit. There's a boxer named Tommy Hearns, and he used to do that with a jab. He would just feint a jab. He would just feint. The way he'd move his shoulder, the way he'd move his eyes. Every single person, Sugar Ray Leonard, Hagler, Duran, they all fell for it. All Tommy Hearns had to do was feint this. He could hit him with the other hand. He could hit him with that hand. It was great. It's a feint. Fine. But the reason I'm spending so much time telling you about it, you'll have a guy like MVP fight, and other people think that he's being cocky. Some people will even go as far as to call him disrespectful. Anderson Silva got billed at times the same way. Roy Jones Jr. at times got billed the same way. And the misunderstanding by the audience is all Anderson, Roy Jones Jr., or in this case MVP, all that they're doing is trying to get a reaction from the opponent. They're not trying to clown him, which is a word that I hear. They're not trying to mock him. They're not trying to be bad sports. They're trying to get him to watch. Like the Ollie Shuffle, The Ollie Shuffle wasn't because it helped the one and the two come out. The Ollie Shuffle was done to make the opponent free, just for a sec, free go. What is he doing? Boom, boom, hit you right down the middle. Now, Ian Garry will do his extremely basic. So basic that many of you don't even know that it's happening. MVP will do his in a way that you will see it and sometimes misinterpret and think it's bad sportsmanship. Either way, to get the best of Garry, step number one is you got to stand up to him. You cannot be scared of him. You have to stand up to him. And we've had opponents at times do just that. Garry was so long and he was so good at what he did that he would change their mind. Not to mention Garry with his offense hurts you. You're not the same guy as you were a minute earlier. You're not the same guy 4 minutes into the fight as you started the fight when you fight Garry. Because all he does is punch and kick. There is no point where he clinches. There is no point where he takes you down and holds you. There's no point where he's looking for a key lock. All he's doing, regardless of power, is punching you over and over. And if he's not, he's kicking you. Garry will wear you down. You must stand up to him. Something tells me MVP will. Now, the other side of the coin for MVP, if you go look at the very few guys who have had success with MVP, it's very few, and I'm going to put Kevin Holland in that group. Kevin Holland was not made to look like a fool. He was made to look like a guy that you don't fool with. But Kevin Holland stood up to him. He did not care about range. He was not one of these guys that's got to be way out here because he knows he can't be hit because he's so scared. Kevin stepped right in there. And in some ways, that threw MVP off. If you ever saw Mike Perry in MVP fight, the one thing Perry did, it wasn't that Perry turned out to be a little better boxer than we thought he was. The number one thing Perry did is he stood up to him. He did not will. He didn't get out of range. He didn't fall for the setups. He didn't fall for the distractions. He went and fought him. My skills versus yours. Let's do this thing until somebody says stop. I bring that to you because I don't believe that Ian Garry is going to wilt to the distance and the ideas or to the intimidation of the setups that are done by MVP. I don't think. And I don't think that MVP is going to wilt. Like, Garry doesn't have five setups. He has one. But it's so good, he can do it to everybody. I'll bring Conor McGregor in just as a name that you know, but he's got this left hand. That's true. It is hard, and it is powerful, and it is long, and it is fast. But he only throws it two ways. That's it. There's two setups. And I only share that with you because it's very surprising to me that over time, those haven't been identified. Khabib, as great as he was with taking you down, did not take you down on the letters of the canvas that say UFC. He took you down 100% of the time when your back was up against the fence. So to stop the takedown, step number one, don't put your back up against the fence. Easier said than done. I'm just sharing for you that while I know this, and even if it's new to you, they know it. MVP knows nothing's come until the setup comes first. And if he can disrupt in that moment, right there in that moment, as soon as that setup, as soon as that feint comes, if MVP has something to disrupt the rhythm, the cross and the jab are never going to fire. And MVP doesn't have just one setup. He's got 7 and 8 and 9. Guys like Mike Perry didn't care about any of them. Guys like Kevin Holland didn't care about any of them. If Ian Garry fights the way I think he's going to fight, he's also not going to care. And now you've got a long, drawn-out battle that eventually comes down to skill and comes down to speed, comes down to technique. Always the most pleasing matches to watch. Who's going to win? Ian Garry, undefeated, possible number one contender, 25, 26-year-old, something along these lines, versus MVP, a cagey veteran at 37. Hard fight, close fight. Possibly the most meaningful fight of the night. Ian Garry. Lopez versus Ortega. Now, DraftKings has this. Are you ready? DraftKings has this. Who do you think the favorite is? Quick pause. Who do you think? Lopez. They gave the nod to Lopez, and it's close. Minus 140, plus 124. How do you feel about that? Like, I watch Lopez, and he sure is fun. Like, he's had back-to-back-to-back. He put a string. Almost like he got lucky, but then he did it again. In terms of excitement, I don't mean in terms of skill. I understand he could have won those fights, but three in a row, and they were just like but really interesting matches. Used his hands, finished these opponents, like, whoa, got on people's radar, had an interesting haircut when he did it. Like, it was one of these things where he kind of quietly crept up and likely would not be in a position where we'd be talking about him today had this card not fallen apart, but that doesn't change his skills. Do you think that's enough to beat a perennial number one contender? A former title challenger who all he had to do was say Ilya Topuria's name and he would have a title fight right now from down a division. I mean, do you understand that? That's how good Ortega is. Like, we don't do different medals here. We just got one belt and it's gold. But there is no silver medal and there is no bronze medal. But let's say that there was. This is a former silver medalist who right now, had he said the words Ilya Topuria, would be signed up to be in that gold medal match again. That's how good he is from down a weight class. Not a former guy, not a former stud, not once upon a time, and now he's moved up. Right here, right now, had he said the words Ilya Topuria into a microphone, he would be in a gold medal match down a weight class. What does that mean when he moves up? And I bring that to you, and you want to know why? Because 45 is harder than 55. If you dispute anything that I just said, if you dispute that he would be fighting for the title, well, we can't go any further. If you understand that he would be right now in the finals, in the Super Bowl, in the gold medal match, right, by any other sports terms, and you understand that 45 is a harder weight class than 55, then you see an opportunity at DraftKings. They got this one wrong. They got this one way wrong, unless you don't agree with something that I just said. Now, the reason I bring it to you and the reason I'm talking about this weight class is that perception will never go away no matter how many times this gets shoved up your ass and down your throat. Like, this will not be accepted by the public. There is a weight advantage. The bigger guy. It's the same thing with a reach advantage. I have no idea how long my arms are. I don't know what your arms are. I just know that Mike Tyson never had a longer arm than one single opponent. And I also know that Mike Tyson never weighed more than one single opponent. But the myth lives on. And I'm not trying to pick on 45 and 55. Like, those are two really great weight classes. I just think that's an interesting concept that no matter how many times this gets proven and disproven, like, we've seen people go for champ status. They were champ here and they came down a weight class. And we see that backfire versus we see a guy at a weight class who moves up another weight class, but then does get champ status. And it's largely a North American idea. Like, in my wrestling day, and I have to bring that in, I don't think there's any sports like this. And even if that's a broad stroke statement, there's no professions like this. There's nothing in the world where, for you to earn a living, you have to get on a scale first. Like, if anybody tried that in any walk of life, they would be sued instantly and they would lose the lawsuit. It's a very unique field. And the same thing goes for sport. Like, you're not going to see baseball or hockey or soccer or badminton or any sport. You have to get on a scale to even be allowed. It's not like, oh, well, it doesn't matter what you weigh. We just want to know what you weigh. And then we're going to put you in anyway. No, not in this sport. We're going to put you on a scale. And if you don't weigh a certain amount, you're not going in. You're not going into the game the next day. It's very unique. So when I share with you weight ideas and philosophies, they're rare. And I would expect that you would listen. And I will share with you when I went overseas, man, I went to wrestle in other countries. It was really just the Americans that are in the sauna or wearing the sweatsuits and are running and spitting and trying to sweat it out and starving the night before, even the week before. It was really just the Americans. Like, the Europeans don't do that. They might lose a kilo or two. They wake up, whatever they weigh, and they gotta go do one workout. They can do it in a short and a t-shirt and go get on the scale. And they're in a relatively good mood anyway, versus the American who can't even speak. Can't even speak. He's so dehydrated and they got to help him to and from the scale. Like, it's largely a North American idea that if I'm a good 185 pounder, I'm going to be a really good 170 pounder, which means I'll go 155. And there's not a lot of times that you can show that that's accurate. You could do it in reverse. You could take a 205-pounder like Daniel Cormier, put him at heavyweight, he'll walk through it and win the gold medal and beat all your biggest stars on his way to doing it. Now, if he goes back to 205, he's not guaranteed to be champion. There's lots of stories like that. And I share that because the one advantage that I see for Brian Ortega is that he's going at 155 pounds. The one advantage, the physiology of it, right? If you had your choice to be more powerful or faster than an opponent, all of you who've never been in a fight will take the power 100% of the time. You'd be taking the wrong one. You'd be much better to have speed. Now, you trade the speed for the conditioning. That's the single most important thing that you can have. Not the combos, not the experience, not anything, not the footwork, whatever that even means. Number one thing that you could have is conditioning. Second thing that you could have is speed. Power certainly does matter at some point. But I share that with you because just by the numbers, when you're moving up a weight, you're automatically faster than your opponent, at least in theory. And if you're a little bit smaller, the advantage that you have is that you can move around longer than he can, at least within theory, if everything else is equal. So when you have an automatic finals, like Brian Ortega, he's either one or two at 145. Two words, Ilya Topuria into a microphone. He would be fighting Ilya Topuria. So now he's either going to beat him or he's not. He's either one or he's two at 145 right now. Right now. And it's really a question of, am I right? Is 45 harder than 55? Is 55 better than 45? Can a guy, a good guy, really good guy, Lopez, beat an absolute top guy no lower than two at 45? Because if he can, it would dispel my entire theory about which weight class is more challenging. And there is such a built-in advantage and there is such a built-in attitude. Aljamain Sterling's going through it right now. He didn't want to go to 145, and as soon as he does, goes and has this great fight against Cater, but his life was also better. His training sessions were also better. Hanging out with him on a human level, he's got his better attitude, better energy, more calories in, better life. I'm just sharing with you, Brian Ortega's going through that right now. And likely for a big part of his career, he wanted to stay at 45. He had reservations about going to 55, but now that it's happening, he's seeing the benefits. And he's seen, like so many others, that is a misconception to go smaller. Always better to go up. It's always better to let the other guy be bigger. The hardest guy to wrestle is the guy from one weight class below you. This may not be true in all sports, but it's combat. It's true in this one. Brian Ortega at DraftKings right this second is an underdog to Lopez. DraftKings has this one wrong. And if you have Lopez, good for you, great fighter, not cheering against you, you've also got it wrong. And if you're favoring Lopez, you're favoring him not for a body of work or something that you've seen in the past. You're favoring because he's bigger, and in your mind, that's better. Though history proves otherwise. So who do I think will win between Pierre and Prochazka, right? My official prediction, but before I get to it, all I need to know, because they both already know the answer to that question. So everything I'm doing is I'm attempting to project for you, like, sure, to add words, I'm going to go back to their first fight, and I'm going to tell you about different positions, and I'm going to talk about the stand-up advantage to Pierre, but if they get on the ground and Prochazka and how good he looked, and if you use Glover Teixeira as a commonality, while an opponent of one, but the coach and mentor of the other. But that's just to add words. All I'm doing when I'm watching the interviews and the breakdowns between Pereira and Prochazka is trying to find out which one is telling the truth when they say they think they can win. They both already know. It is presented to you, the audience, as two guys that are positive, that have done everything and they've trained and they've sacrificed. These two guys already know. And the question is, which one of them? Which one of them has the tail or the poker hand? I was in a situation in the year 2000. There was a tournament called the University World Championships. They now call it U23. And I had access to a very elite level of training which is I was able to work out with Randy Couture and Dan Henderson every day. And they were on a different level. They were on the senior level. They were going to the senior world championships. So I'm down a grade at the university, but I have access to these training partners, and therefore, I'm going to win the whole thing. Now, whether that makes sense or not, I believed it. And I also had a special training exercise for my cardio that nobody else had. They didn't know this workout. If you were curious what that was, it was 3 minutes of jump rope followed by 3 minutes on a heavy bag, 3 minutes of jump rope, 3 minutes of heavy bag, and you did them both three times. Now, as I look back at that now and what I know now, that is an extremely easy workout, and I would probably chalk that up to a cool down after a real workout. But at that time of my life, that was all I would do. I would go in the gym and I would do that, but this was a secret workout. Now I'm in better shape than anybody, and I took that with me into the World Championships, and I believed it. In the very first round, I wrestled a guy from Estonia who I'd never seen before. I'd never met him. I'd never seen him. We drew each other the first round. I had never touched him until I shook his hand right there and the referee blew the whistle. And I put that dominance, that pace, and that pressure that I had from these secret workouts with my advanced senior level training partners. And the rules of wrestling back then is you had to have 3 points or the match didn't end. Now, if you went the entire match, which was 6 minutes, if you were ahead, which I was ahead 1-0, but we still had to go into overtime. And overtime would exhaust its time, which was 3 minutes, which means all of a sudden you're now in a 9-minute match, unless one guy can get to three. Fine. As ridiculous as those rules are, which thank goodness wrestling doesn't do anymore, I had to wrestle this guy for 9 minutes. Final score was 1-0. I had never had a 9-minute wrestling match. Even my college wrestling matches were 7 minutes. All of my high school matches were six. And there was an overtime and there was a way to get to 9 minutes, but I never had. So this was the longest wrestling match that I've ever been in. What nobody understood is it was the hardest match I had ever been in, at least from a cardio standpoint. I had never reached that level of fatigue. So the way the bracketing worked in wrestling is even if you guys met up, there was a way to meet up again in the finals. There was something that used to be known as a cross bracket. So the guy from Estonia that I have in the very opening match, the next day I have for the gold medal. And you would think, as my coaches did and as my parents did and as any onlookers did, that whatever confidence I had going into that first match with him, whether that was up or down, but whatever the confidence was, if I'm going to wrestle the same guy one day later, who, by the way, I just beat, my confidence would be more. Can we agree on that, logically speaking? And that's the way I acted, and that's the way I pretended. But I had a secret that nobody else knew. And my secret was I was very apprehensive to go back to the vulnerable spot that I was in, specifically the fatigue that I had reached with this guy. I was aware what a hard match that was going to be. I was aware of what kind of fight it was going to take. And I'd already done it once and beat him in the same tournament. And I didn't think it was right in the first place that he could, like, even if he beats me, well, now we're tied one apiece, but he gets the gold medal. Like, it was just one of these things. But I kept it to myself and I had no way to express it. In fact, I've never expressed it until right this moment, 24 years later. And I don't offer it to you as a counseling session. It's not one of those that haunts me. But it is something and a tool and a piece of information that I have. So when I watch Prochaska and I watch Piera, regardless of the fact that they first fought, regardless that Prochaska was the favorite, regardless that Piera beat him or not, regardless that Piera stopped him, as a matter of fact, regardless of it, doesn't look like it was all that hard of a fight. I mean, it was scheduled for up to 25 minutes, and he stopped him in around 7 or 8 minutes. This is off the top of my head. Don't think you need to correct me. My point is, it didn't go the duration. It was not a back-and-forth battle. It wasn't like Piera the night that he won the world championship, where he's down 4 rounds and has to finish in the fifth. But while those things might appear to be accurate, there's a secret, and there's something that only those two athletes know. And my father was never like okay with fighting or street fighting or something like that. He was not. But like so many dads, there was days when he rolled his sleeves up after work and moved the coffee table, and he would show me, if something like this happened, things that you can do to make sure you prevail. But one thing he was a very big believer in is that if that happens and you win, you want to win by a lot. And my dad, it was never about hurting the other kid. That was never his mentality on beat him by a lot. You got to beat him bad. Whatever, you got to do it. His belief was, if you beat him, he's going to want revenge. He's going to want to get his buddies. He's going to want to find you again, or he's going to want to try again. You have to prove the point that you do not want to try this again. This is now settled between us. This is the way it went. We go our separate ways. It's very hard to do. My father's philosophy is right. I'll give you an example. It pertains to Prochaska specifically, but one of the great minds of MMA is King Mo Lawal. King Mo, this guy, he knows grappling. Like, if you were going into a submission match, you'd want him in your corner. If you were going into a straight-up wrestling match, you'd want him in your corner. If you're going to a boxing match, you would want him in your corner. Like, he is one of the great minds of combat. He fought Yuri Prochaska. He beat him. As a matter of fact, King Mo TKO'd him. And King Mo came out of that match, the winner, by stoppage. Said, I never want to fight that guy again. And it was back to the theory that my dad had, but it was in reverse. The victor, the guy who won, learned enough about the opponent, in this case, Prochaska. He said, I never want to fight him again. And Mo said that you can't see it on the outside. You can only feel the spirit and the will of Prochaska when you're in there with him. You can only feel when you hit him as hard as you can that he'll grunt as he's coming forward, as opposed to stopping or backing away or trying to catch his breath. Like, Mo was trying to explain this to me. And I didn't know it about Prochaska, and I hadn't seen it. But I'd had my experience at the University World Championships with this guy from Estonia. And I did understand what Mo was saying, that regardless of outcome, you will find things out within that match. And if you can get it in the rear view and never revisit it, you're better off. The very next day, the guy from Estonia, who I had beaten, beat me. And King Mo had to rematch Prochaska, the guy who he had stopped. And Prochaska beat him. So when I tell you that there's things that the audience can't see, and when I tell you that the two athletes know, they know. Now, they will cling to and hang their hat on the idea of, and then you can fill in the blank, which is, what if he has a bad night? What if he slips? What if his shoulder goes back out? What if I can set up with my hook and land my cross? That can put him down. Like, as unlikely as it is, and as much as it's probably not going to happen, and I really don't want to face this guy, I do have a way to go. I am a competitor, and I am a man, and I am going to prepare, and I'm going to hope for the best. But that is still what one of them is doing. They are both pretending, and they are both acting, and they are both conducting and carrying on. But your job as the viewer is to see which one is telling the truth. And you will generally have the great blink in the willingness. One of them, particularly on short notice, is going to be more willing to accept than the other. And that just didn't happen here. It just didn't. They both came forward and came together quickly. That's just not usually how it's done. You got two real warriors here. You got two guys with real spirit here. You got two guys who have felt each other, respect each other, but understand what needs to be done to defeat the other one. So when I'm asked who's going to win between Pierre and Prochaska, I don't ever have to think about left hand, right hand, southpaw orthodox, conditioning, strength, experience. I don't have to think about any of those things. Because I know they both already know. And now it's just a game of figuring out which one's telling the truth. And in this case, the one who's telling the truth is Alex Pereira.
All right, everybody.
everybody, that is it for today's episode. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the brilliance you just heard, then I suggest you leave me a 5-star review on Apple or submit a 5-star rating on Spotify. Have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy the fights. Until next time, I'm Chael Sonnen, and you are welcome.